You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 14th of June 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
NATO meets in Brussels. We'll have the latest. US President Joe Biden prepares to meet his Russian counterpart and a post-mortem of the recently concluded G7. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily in association with Allianz starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Lou Lukens and Mary Dejewski will be reviewing or previewing a week boasting more summits than the Himalayas and revealing what the time since they were last here has taught them to appreciate or not about their own homes. Stay tuned. That's all coming up right here on the Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests today are Lou Lukens, former US diplomat, now senior partner with Signum Global Advisors, and Mary Dejewski, columnist for The Independent. Week two of the new daily. The novelty of having guests back in the studio has not worn off in the least. You're both back. Delightful to see you. Mary, I will ask you first, what arcane hobbies have you been devoting yourself to since you were last here?
I have been doing what I think practically everybody has been doing during the various lockdowns, which is daily permitted exercise, which involved experiments in how far I could get in a round trip of an hour from my flat, and sorting. And I'm now on the last stage of sorting, and the last stage of sorting is I've done books, I've done files, I've done papers, I'm on to the vinyl records.
Wow. How meticulous is your sorting? I mean, when you say sorting, does this mean just scooping up armfuls of stuff and heaving it into the garbage, which is my own preferred approach, or are you a little bit more methodical?
I'm much more methodical and very tidy and very systematic, and I label everything and then throw half of it out.
Lou, I don't think we've had a guest yet confess to sourdough. Would you like to be the first? Or
No, thank you. I do want to say first, I would like to have Mary come do my sorting because she sounds amazing. I turned my dining room is now a dining room slash office slash home gym. So I spent a lot of time in that room either, doing push-ups or doing phone calls or eating.
Did you ever attempt to do all three at once?
No, but they all sort of counter each other out, right?
So yeah,
I do the push-ups and then I eat and then...
It's the circle of life. Anyway, moving probably mercifully along. Today's show will be something of a summit. We'll be discussing the NATO summit in Brussels today, looking ahead to the Biden-Putin summit in Geneva on Wednesday, and reflecting on what we may have learned from the past weekend's G7 summit in Cornwall. But first of all, we can go to the NATO summit in Brussels, specifically to Michael Birnbaum, Brussels Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Michael, welcome to the show. What have we learned from the summit so far?
Well, thanks so much for having me. This is the first NATO summit with President Joe Biden. The last few years, every time the leaders came together, they were petrified that President Trump would blow it up. So this is a chance for them to get together and have that not happen, to demonstrate some unity. But there are still some divisions right now about their stance towards China, how they handle the Afghanistan pullout, and also still about defense spends remains a big U.S. focus.
That compare and contrast is obviously going to be a dominant theme of this summit, that this is President Joe Biden and very much not President Donald Trump. But do you get the sense that there is still any hangover from the Trump years? Because while it was never entirely clear that President Trump understand what NATO was for or how it worked, his complaints about laggardly spending and laggardly commitments by other allies weren't entirely without merit, were they?
Well, it's certainly the case that there are many, a majority of NATO countries that don't meet the defense spending guidelines that they themselves use. That's 2% of their annual economic turnover. Most countries are falling short. That's not the case of the United States. And there's increasingly a feeling in the United States, I mean, this predated Trump, but it was definitely stoked and encouraged by Trump, that the United States is being taken advantage of, that Europe is not doing enough to contribute to its own defense and is instead relying on the United States. And those concerns are all still present, and that's still an issue. Defense spending has been rising. It continues to rise. But there are questions about what's going to happen now, both that President Trump is no longer in office, and so there's a friendlier tone from Biden, and also there's a lot of pressure on economies and governments because of the pandemic to spend money elsewhere, not so much on defense.
Has there been any great thinking about what NATO's role is going to be, how it's going to evolve over the next, well, let's say 5 to 10 years? Is it still all about Russia?
That is probably the biggest focus of this summit, what to do with NATO over the next 10 years. They're very explicit about that. And President Biden and the United States are indeed pushing NATO to take a look at China as an emerging security threat. They want a lot more focus on China, even as they continue to NATO against Russia. And they say they can do both. There are concerns among some alliance members that focusing too much on China will lead to neglecting the Russia question. But, you know, President Biden is going to Geneva in the coming days to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin. And so the U.S. side says, you know, we can do both, but the alliance does need to adapt.
Michael Birnbaum of The Washington Post at the NATO summit in Brussels. Thank you for joining us. You are listening to The Daily. Still with me are Mary Dujewski and Lou Lukens. Now, today's gathering of NATO leaders will have been not so much a summit as a chorus of sighs of relief that the alliance's most powerful member is now represented by someone who isn't Donald Trump, who, as we've just been hearing, made no secret of his contempt for NATO and his lack of understanding of what it was for or indeed how it worked. But Lou, first of all, and this is something that we touched on there with Michael, is it still arguable that Trump's rattling of NATO's complacency might actually have been a good thing, even if it didn't necessarily come from a good or indeed informed place?
Yeah, it was not a bad thing in the sense that those countries have committed to a certain level of spending. And President Obama, before President Trump, tried to encourage the countries to lift their spending levels, probably not forcefully enough. Donald Trump came in and probably pushed the issue too hard or less diplomatically. But he certainly made the point. And I think the amount of contributions from those countries did rise during Trump's time in office, large part probably because they wanted him to stop yelling at them.
Mary, Russia is, of course, I think, still generally perceived within NATO as the first order of business. And I will come to you about that shortly. But before we do that, we have a clip of NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg referring to a couple of Russia's neighbors.
Our relationship with Russia is at its lowest point since the Cold War. And Moscow's aggressive actions are a threat to our security. NATO remains committed to our dual-track approach of defense and dialogue. We will keep our defenses strong while remaining ready to talk, to make our positions clear, avoid misunderstanding, and prevent escalation. We fully support the decision to extend the New START treaty, and we would welcome new strategic talks on future arms control, with continued coordination here at NATO. We stand in solidarity with our valued partners, Ukraine and Georgia, and we will continue to support their reforms, bringing them closer to NATO.
Mary, there's an amount of carrot and stick there. He was talking, you know, constructively about maybe things that NATO and Russia might not disagree on, but reminding Russia, I think, that NATO has not taken its eye off Georgia or Ukraine, how will that have been heard in Moscow?
I think that Moscow will not just have been listening to Jens Stoltenberg. I think they will have been reading the communique. And if they read the communique, they would have been even less enamoured than they would have been from what Jens Stoltenberg said. Because as I read the communique, and certainly with half an eye to how it might be received in Moscow, I would say that about two-thirds of the communique or more of it deals with basically slagging off Russia. Yes, there are these little carrots every now and again, and what seemed to me when there was talk of, you know, it would be nice if we had some more arms control, and yes, by the way, it ought to go through NATO, so, you know, that's the instructions to Joe Biden right there, not to give anything away on a sort of bilateral front when he meets Putin in Geneva. But it did strike me as, on the one hand, a very hawkish communique in Russia's direction, but also that part of the explanation for that might have been something that was referred to from Brussels, which was how far NATO is actually looking for other things to do. The question and the disagreement that there is on what priority to give China. Because again, when you go back to the communique, there is one paragraph, only one paragraph, which relates to China. And it emphasizes that China must not be seen as an adversary. And it's very clear about that. So the tone that's used to China and the attention that's given to China is of a completely different order from that towards Russia.
We will be talking more about Russia later in the show as we look ahead to the Geneva summit. But Mary, seeing as how you seamlessly teed that up, this is what Jens Stoltenberg had to say about China.
At the summit today, we addressed China. There is strong convergence of views among allies. Based on our interests, we see opportunities to engage on issues such as arms control and climate change. But China's growing influence and international policies present challenges to alliance security.
Is China, Lou, really NATO's natural beat? This is a huge expansion of NATO's remit, isn't it? This is, of course, an organization that was first formed 72 years ago to counterbalance the Soviet Union in Europe. Is this an example of NATO, as Mary seemed to suggest, looking for something to do?
A little bit, yeah. It's not NATO's natural beat, and certainly way beyond what it was originally created for. I think, you know, the G7 summit is a natural place to talk about China and address the issues with China. And I think Biden's meetings tomorrow with EU leaders is another natural venue to talk about China. NATO strikes me as a little bit of an odd venue to talk about China as a strategic competitor. But I think this sort of highlights the focus that the Biden administration has on China. And China is sort of the overlays almost every policy decision the Biden administration is making. They see Russia as a threat, but not nearly as much of a threat as they see China. So I think by trying to inject some China language into a NATO communique, that is Joe Biden's attempt to sort of put China on notice that we're looking at you from all possible angles.
There was just one more clip from Stoltenberg I wanted to play because it struck me as an extremely interesting point in his address, because this is something that I know that is being discussed increasingly seriously in defense circles, and it is climate change. And it's possibly not that surprising that defense departments and militaries who tend to have to think logically about problems and how they can actually deal with them with the resources they have are actually getting out in front of this and seeing it as a security challenge. This is Stoltenberg again.
Leaders agreed that for the first time, addressing the security impact of climate change will be an important task for NATO. This will include regular assessments of the impact of climate change on our installations, missions, and other activities, integrating climate change into our exercises, defense planning, and procurement, and developing a methodology for assessing greenhouse gas emissions from military activities.
A quick final thought from you on this one, Lou. Is it possible that the mighty militaries of the world could end up being what save us?
They could. Look, the U.S. military some years ago decided that climate change was a national security threat, and they couldn't really talk about that much when Donald Trump was president, but they are re-embracing that notion, I think. And, you know, they very much recognize the impact that climate change has on vulnerable communities and how it tests military strength and it tests the U.S. military capabilities. So they're definitely looking at that. And it would be sort of ironic if at the end of the day the military become our saviors on climate change. I'm not sure they will become our saviors, but they certainly will be part of the solution, I think.
Well, let's look ahead now to Geneva on Wednesday. And when looking ahead to that summit between US President Joe Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin, Biden at least does not have the burden of a tough act to follow. The previous such summit between Putin and President Donald Trump in Helsinki in 2018 left horror-struck American diplomats, politicians, and correspondents requiring both hands to retrieve their jaws from the floor. Even some of those generally supportive of Trump were appalled and or bewildered by his apparently servile demeanor. Mary, how different a proposition will Putin see Biden as being? I mean, Biden is a known quantity. Putin understands what he's dealing with. And off the top of my head, I'm losing count of how many presidents Putin has by now seen off. But how different will he see this as opposed to dealing with Trump?
Well, I think Putin is actually now already on the record as saying that Biden is, as it were, more predictable. I think predictable was the word.
That's a great passive-aggressive euphemism, isn't it?
But I think he'll also be a known quantity in all sorts of other ways, given that he was Obama's deputy, given that he's been in the sort of security field, international relations, for so long. So I think that to that extent, he is a known quantity. But the other thing is that I think Putin will be quite wary because he might have questions in his mind about why Biden is meeting him so early in his presidency. Because, you know, Biden came in on the, as it were, the coattails of Donald Trump, where Russia was this gigantic issue in Washington. And any sort of hint of being even slightly friendly towards Russia, and that would include meeting Putin, seemed to be absolutely excluded, that the whole of the political establishment in Washington was hugely hostile to the idea of any warming relations with Russia. And Biden seemed to be absolutely on that agenda, right through his campaign and right through the first months of his presidency. Then suddenly we got wind that there was a summit being negotiated, and then it was seemed to be brought forward, and lo and behold, it's happening on Wednesday. And I think, on the one hand, Biden has to be quite careful. I would expect you'll find quite a lot of, in his version of what happens there, you'll find quite a hard line that he can take back to Washington and say, look, I'm a completely different character from Trump in everything, but including in how I treat Putin. So, you know, I think we're going to have a... I haven't given anything away, not the slightest concession to Putin. But, you know, what goes on behind the surface and a bit further down, maybe some sort of preliminary agreement to talk about arms control again, that's probably as far as it'll get.
Lou, Mary is quite right to state that Biden has been ostentatiously hawkish on Russia these last few years. And that was obviously a means of establishing a point of difference between him and Donald Trump, who, shall we say, was not hawkish on Russia. But might that be the very reason that Biden has pushed for an early summit? Might he just be thinking, this is an easy win? I meet the fellow in person. I take an obviously robust line. I don't do a joint press conference, which is apparently not on the cards. And I manage to communicate the sense that I have gone up to him and told him to his face what's what.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he's got very little to lose from this. And he, as you know, Mary noted, like the president will come out and there'll be his statement of what happened. I think this time we will actually have a real record of what is said in the meeting as opposed to when Trump met Putin and then tore up the interpreter's notes and nobody really knows what transpired in that meeting. I think this will be a very different scenario this time. But I think this Joe Biden is very much a pragmatist, and he can go back to Washington. And if he gets any political flack from the right wing, the Republicans, for meeting with Putin, he can say, look, President Putin is an adversary of the United States, but we are two superpowers somewhat. You know, Russia is not really a superpower, but they're still able to cause trouble around the world. And we need to be able to work together and find areas of common cooperation. And that's what I did.
Just a final quick thought on this one, Mary. Joe Biden has said that he wants, and I quote, a stable and predictable relationship with Russia. Is that actually an option?
Well, there will be probably a majority of people out there who have half an eye on Russia who would say absolutely not, because look at how Putin has behaved, as they would put it, in the last sort of 10 years or so. Completely unpredictable, they will say, over Georgia, completely unpredictable over annexing Ukraine, annexing Crimea from Ukraine, that these show that Putin is just as, if you like, as capricious as Donald Trump. I think that's actually a complete misreading of Putin, who I think is indeed quite defensive, quite careful, not rash. And so I think the idea that there could be a predictable relationship. I mean, the problem for people like me is that predictable relationship means boring, you know, stable and boring.
I think, though, where Russia is concerned, I think the United States would sign for boring at this point.
I think probably the rest of us would too.
Mary Dejewski and Lou Lukens, thank you both for the moment. We will have more from you shortly. You are listening to The Daily on Monocle 24.
Allianz is proud to partner The Monocle Daily on Monocle 24. Since 1890, Allianz has stood side by side with people as they overcame the impossible. Allianz has always been an innovator. Allianz secures people's future, giving them confidence in tomorrow. Allianz knows how important it is to have a fair partner at your side, to provide solid and sustainable solutions. Allianz strives to do it right, with passion, every day. Allianz, confidence in tomorrow.
Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are my guests, Lou Lukens and Mary Dejewski. Well, having done the summit that is happening and the summit that will happen, let us complete our bingo card of tenses by contemplating the summit which has happened, i.e. this past weekend's G7 summit held in Cornwall. This was widely heralded as some sort of return to something, being the first wingding of quite such import held since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, the getting done of Brexit and the defenestration of Donald Trump. While all who attended appear to have enjoyed themselves, or at least not conceived any lasting grudges as a result, did it do the rest of us any good? Mary, as the representative at this table of the United Kingdom, what did you make of Boris Johnson as host?
I thought it was very interesting watching Boris Johnson as host, because I did think that in a lot of ways this sort of event, and especially, you know, I think the British are really quite good at stage managing these things. And from the location to the choreography, it looked absolutely spectacular. And I also think that this is something that it plays to Boris Johnson's strengths. And I think people forget that he was a two-term mayor of London. And being mayor of London is, it requires some of the very same qualities that it requires to host a global summit meeting. You have to be there. You have to look sort of as though you're with Boris, as though you're a character. People sort of see him as a known quantity, and I think he finds it quite easy to socialise at that level. And often, you know, we've seen in the past when there've been difficult diplomatic things to be sorted out, Boris Johnson actually being there and going to talk to people in person, it solves things. He's got a way of doing this. Now, you may say that it solves it. You look at Northern Ireland and you say it solves it for about 5 minutes. But 5 minutes, or the equivalent, for something like a G7 summit is actually enough. And I think although he may not have got everything that he wanted, there was the row over Northern Ireland, essentially the row with the European Union that was sort of hanging in the background of that summit. But I think in terms of his personal image and his role as the Prime Minister of Brexit Britain, I actually think it went quite well for him.
Lou, one thought from you on this. One of the substantive things that was supposed to come out of G7 was President Joe Biden's big idea of a global corporate tax rate to stop big corporations from moving their profits around willy-nilly so they don't end up paying any or at least much tax on them. Do you think he made that stick? Is that going to go anywhere? Because obviously that is very much an idea of the easier said than done variety.
Well, the G7 agreed to that actually about a week before the summit with the finance ministers, but that's only the first step. Now it has to go, I think, the G20. This is actually an OECD-run process. So there's a ways to go, I think, before we have global agreement or enough global agreement on a global minimum corporate tax. I do think it will happen. I think the many of the countries involved are eager to see this happen. So I think we will see this by the end of the year. But this is not a G7 really issue. It's much broader than that.
Well, finally on today's program, here in London, cultural institutions are opening their doors again. And after a year spent staring at the four walls of our houses or apartments, what better place to go than a museum of the home? But after a three-year renovation, the museum in Hackney reopened to the public on Saturday. Monocle's Alexa Self hung up his dressing gown at last and took the Hammersmith and City Line east.
On the northern edge of the City of London, in the old East End neighbourhood of Hoxton, a row of 18th century almshouses opens out onto neat, tree-lined lawns. Herein lies the Museum of the Home, an institution founded to explore the evolution of the British domestic space from the 1600s to the present. It reopened to the public on Saturday the 12th of June, after a three-year renovation project. The £18 million makeover has brought its exhibition spaces firmly into the 21st century, and its reopening would seem to come at the perfect time. After a year of domestic immurement, our fascination with our own homes is unsurprisingly more pronounced. Well, at least mine is. So, ahead of the museum's reopening, I came out from behind the curtains and went down to Hoxton to peruse its collections. Part of the renovation has involved converting old underground coal cellars into a series of exhibition spaces, focusing on the personal experiences of ordinary Londoners. Photos and audio recordings help illustrate the impacts of things like war and gentrification on the domestic space. These include the heartwarming story of Pat, an octogenarian Londoner who opened her home to a family of Syrian refugees.
She likes My Fair Lady. What's the one? I don't know what's the name of My Fair Lady song.
There's I Could Have Danced All Night, and the other one is Lovely.
I can't remember.
I will help you.
That sort of.
All I want is a room somewhere.
All right, the cold night air with one enormous chair.
Increased exhibition space has allowed the museum's curators to display more of its impressive collection of objects, from antique Georgian furniture to Super Nintendos. Fulcrum of the museum's collection is still its series of historical domestic spaces on the ground floor. Starting in the 1630s, with wood-panelled walls and lots of candles, and running through to a 1990s loft, bedizened with Conran shop furniture and a River Cafe cookery book lying open on the counter. Tucked in between, as a representative for the 1970s, is the West Indian front room. Designed by the playwright Michael Macmillan, it's an homage to British Caribbean identity, featuring brightly coloured carpets, numerous trinkets, and a record player stacked high with vinyl. I asked Macmillan what reactions the space had been getting.
All the conversations I've had with journalists was about their own families and growing up. And this is what this room does. The material culture triggers in them something of, well, I grew up with like this, or we had this, and this is what we had. And then we start talking about home and what home means, and then we begin to talk about the experience of the pandemic with home. Those stories are amazing. They're all different, you know. So one of the things I've been conscious of that, I've added details here. So one of the things about this room is kids weren't allowed, but then there's toys underneath there. I've deliberately put that there. Well, we've got Woolworths, VHS bags that people remember. Those are things that are gone, but that's part of our history. So little details, the packet of cigarettes. I think I've got an asteroid in there now.
After speaking to Michael, I wandered outside to the museum's garden, which features a panoply of urban horticulture through the ages. A Tudor kitchen planted next to a modern allotment. There I sat down with Museum of the Home director Sonia Solicari to discuss the reopening.
A museum of the home, I mean, that's such a big topic, isn't it? So the way that we approach it is we have these jumping off points, really, that open up bigger questions about domestic experience, about emotions, about psychology, about the bricks and mortar, about the objects we live with, about the people we live with. So the idea is that you are presented with examples, but you're encouraged to think about how that relates to your own experience. Well, I think a lot of us have been desperate during lockdown to get into other people's homes, you know, because that was forbidden. We were in our own homes a lot and we're asking a lot of questions of our own homes. But I think that idea of visiting others and being in others' domestic spaces, which is absolutely kind of what we cater for here at the Museum of the Home, you kind of can have a look and immerse yourself in other people's homes and domestic experiences. But I think definitely over the last year we've seen an increased interest and focus on what home means, and also the future of home. It's a question that we're asked a lot here at the museum: what's the future of home? And often that is in relation to people's experience of home working as well during lockdown. I mean, not everyone obviously was at home. A lot of people went out to work, but I think a lot of us, myself included, were working from home and have got the question: what does that mean for both my home and my workspace?
I left the garden and walked around to the front of the museum. Before the redesign, this place was called the Jeffrey Museum, named for Robert Jeffrey, a former Lord Mayor of London, at whose behest the almshouses were built in 1714. A part of Jeffrey's fortune was generated from the transatlantic slave trade, and a statue of him which stands above the old entrance to the building has become a source of tension in the local community. Before the reopening, the museum requested to have it taken down, but was rebuked by the Culture Secretary Oliver Dowden, whose ministry funds the institution. Instead, a plaque placed beneath it explains Jeffrey's past. Whether or not this intended compromise diffuses the situation remains to be seen. Of all the museum's artifacts, it demonstrates the most uncomfortable home truth. For Monocle, at the Museum of the Home in London, I'm Alexis Self.
Thank you, Alexis, at the Museum of the Home in Hackney. And obviously, as the intro to that suggested, Lou and Mary, we have spent a lot of time, probably this last year or so, thinking about the places we live in. So, Lou, I'll ask you first. I wanted to ask, over the last year and a bit of probably thinking more than you wanted to about where you live, is there an aspect of it you've come to particularly like and an aspect of it you've come to particularly dislike? For me, for example, I've been very grateful for my garden, whereas I have, especially in recent months, developed a kind of double-decker blind furious loathing for my kitchen, but an even more intense blind furious loathing of the prospect of actually doing anything about it.
Well, I live in a flat on the third floor, so I love the light that I get every day, and I love being able to look down onto a high street. So even if I feel alone and isolated at home, I can stand on the balcony or look out the window and see people and see activity and not feel quite so isolated. So that's what I like about it. I think that what's caused me the most stress about home in the last year is every time I'm on an interview or a phone call for work, I'm terrified that the doorbell is going to ring and my 5-pound Yorkshire Terrier is going to go insane. and it happens quite frequently. And it's sort of the Amazon delivery guy just has he knows when I'm on an important call, and that's when he rings the doorbell and all hell breaks loose.
I mean, I would like to think so. If I was a delivery driver, I would totally do that. If you could find some way which you knew that ringing the bell would cause maximum havoc, I mean, why would you not? Mary, have you developed a particular like or dislike about where you live?
I've developed a particular like because I live in a flat too, and I'm on the 7th floor. And through the flat faces three directions, and two of them are out into the open and the sky, and you can see huge distances, even in London. And you can look at what's being built. Things have been built over the last 18 months that you would never dream being built. The skyline's changed a bit. But it's actually it's the sunsets and the moon, and what you can, you know, it's amazing what you can see, just the time you can spend watching as the sun goes down. And there've been some spectacular sunsets, especially during the first lockdown. That was the sort of compensation, and you felt maybe it was something to do with maybe the air being cleaner, there being fewer planes in the sky, fewer cars on the streets. Who knows?
That was such a poetic answer. I'm not going to ask you about what you've learned to dislike. That is it for this edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks to the panellists today, Mary Dijewski and Lou Lukens, also to Michael Birnbaum and to Monocle's Alexa Self. The show was produced by Carlotta Rebello and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our sound engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 UK. I'll be your host for that as well. Thank you for listening.